That's a legendary Cuban music icon and pianist, Bebo Valdez's son, Chucho Valdez, noted composer, bandleader, arranger, and also a pianist. That's the tune Yanza. This is Chucho Valdez's group, the Afro-Cuban Messengers, taking off from the Jazz Messengers. And he's one of my favorites. Yanza is inspired by the Yoruba religion, and it is a call to the deity Orisha. It's from his all-acoustic 2010 album, Chucho's Steps, which won the Grammy for Best Latin Jazz Album the following year, one of about almost a dozen he has won so far in his career, spanning almost 50 years, 5-0. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and, well, for Republican and Democratic candidates alike, Charleston, South Carolina, is where it's at. As the 2016 presidential race kicks into gear with early primaries, so does the mad dash for votes. For Republican and Democratic candidates, South Carolina is a critical proving ground, and GOP hopefuls will be facing off in a two-tiered Q&A session. I refuse to call these things debates. Their sixth so-called debate tonight at the North Charleston Coliseum and Performing Arts Center. The Democrats will have their slugfest, their fourth, in Charleston as well on the 17th. But they've ramped up their presence there and are aggressively trolling for votes, black votes specifically, in this historically Democratic stronghold. So we'll take a look at this and expand a bit on the previous commentary I did on the significance of South Carolina's black vote. Well, let's talk first about what might happen tonight, what is scheduled to be happening as the Republican slugfest proceeds on prime time as a main event, and the so-called undercard, the folks who didn't quite cut it and have to appear, have to sit at the little table. They don't get invited to the main Thanksgiving table. They have to sit at the little table tonight, and that is at 6 o'clock, the main event, because these things have now been transformed into events. They used to be about citizen education and civic education, but it's now a media event. And the media, as I've talked about this quite a few times, have decided to put themselves in charge of what the electorate will know. And they've made up the rules, and it is no longer about public education. It is about the different media entities supposedly hosting these events, making their case for gobs of money that are expected to roll out quite vigorously very soon, as the candidates spend sizable chunks of their campaign war chest on advertising. And so tonight we have the Fox Business Network hosting this event, and seven candidates will be participating in the main so-called prime time discussion at 9 o'clock, and they include front runner Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, his closest competitor, Marco Rubio of Florida, Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida, retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and John Kasich, former governor of Maryland. So they will square off in the so-called main event. The undercard candidates, I feel, you know, this is just so funny saying all of this because it is so patently clear what a horrible corruption of this whole process is. The media hijacking, what the League of Women Voters were happy to do as a public service and with a genuine intent to have the candidates present their views to the public. The media then having some degree, I mean, you have to say it, it had some degree of integrity then, and they too had thought of these so-called debates as a way of having the public get an appreciation of what's at stake in these elections, these national elections. And they were actually performing a journalistic service then. But now we have this total putrid exercise. I get so angry every time I talk about it because it is happening, and they're pretending it's not happening, and they're happy that it's happening, and the news is being dictated and influenced heavily by the suits upstairs, the legal department and the sales department. These are the people who are shaping news today, and we see that from the point of view that Al Jazeera, as a matter of fact, has announced that it will be going out of business. It will be shutting down its U.S. operations. It has been choked out of the market, although, to my mind, it was doing journalism, certainly at a much higher level than the pretenders that we see now, who are pure. I don't know what to call this. I don't know what it's called, but they insist it's journalism. Well, we have Carly Fiorina, Mike Huckabee, and Rick Santorum participating in the undercard event at 6 p.m. Rand Paul was invited to participate, but he said, forget it. I am not going to have the media dictate to me that I'm a second-rate candidate and then endorse it by going along with this contrived program that you have where you decide via polls and whatever else, whatever rules you have instituted to decide who gets to appear when, who is worthy, who is not, who is first tier, who is second tier. He said he's not participating in it. And there's a good reason to admire a person taking a stand like that. It is to the shame of this thing called journalism. I think that deserves a long string of investigative pieces and great debate itself. The role of the media in absolutely corrupting the process and interposing and imposing itself as the arbiter of democracy. I think that's a very, very serious infraction. And they seem to have no problem with it. So that's what's happening tonight. As usual, you know, we'll get the rancor and the jabs and all of that that is passing for very heavy thinking these days. People getting very personal and hateful and showing, in fact, the crisis that we're in. It's intellectual deficit at the highest places in government. We have absolutely the wrong people. Most of them are the worst possible choices to run for public office. They suggest instead a need for deep psychological counseling, about 20 or 30 years worth, to get them to be quasi-normal and acceptable. I wouldn't want to be sharing a meal with any of these people. I wouldn't want these people in my house. I wouldn't want these people around growing children. They ought to be protected from people like this and their so-called values that they have. And yet, this is uniformly the caliber that we have running for the highest office in this country. And that brings me to Hillary Clinton. Great segue, wouldn't you say? Hillary Clinton. Well, let's see. Sister Hillary, you remember her. She went down to South Carolina. South Carolina is very, very important. Why? Because it actually is the seat of the Democratic Party. It's one of the strongholds, one of the bastions of Democratic support. And that is not accidental. Now, you should keep in mind, South Carolina was the seat of the slavocracy of the South. South Carolina was it. It hasn't changed. You will recall that when President Obama went to South Carolina in the aftermath of that mass shooting by a white supremacist, including the death of an elected state senator there, that I remarked how ironic it was that he was dwarfed by a statue at the very place where this funeral was being held, and nobody seemed to catch it. He was dwarfed by a statue of the great supremacist of the South. And it just didn't hold. It didn't even strike anybody as odd that that should happen, or that should be the case. Similarly, when he made that speech at the Edmund Pettus Bridge, same thing. All around the South, living, breathing testimony of its slave-free past, its slave-entrenched past. And people seem to think, well, this is 2016. That was then, this is now. We're in two different places. And yet, South Carolina is the place where the Democratic Party has always gotten its fair share of support, and early in the game. This is now happening before the early voting primaries and caucuses. And South Carolina, everybody's looking to South Carolina. The Republicans are not so thrilled about it. But the Democrats, this is the Democratic Party's stronghold, South Carolina. Okay. You may remember Sister Hillary going to South Carolina herself. And I called her Sister Hillary because she was waxing all philosophic. Barack Obama went to South Carolina and cried and sang a slave song. Oh, my God. Oh, Lord, it is so sad. And with such conviction, I thought he was one of the Shylites or something. He was singing Amazing Grace, written by the captain of a slave ship. He said, well, he saw the light eventually, and he came around to a good Christian character. But the point is, the song was thanking God for sparing him peril and death on the sea. Of course, he did refer to the cargo underneath. The song has nothing to do with the cargo. The hundreds of slaves shackled, inhumanely stacked, the quarry that he was transporting. People don't associate Amazing Grace with that kind of stuff. They talk about how this man was redeemed. So he wrote this wonderful song, which black people so fervently sing, including the president, to demonstrate the grace of God. You see, I say you have to be disjointed. You have to be psychologically and intellectually disjointed to accept these things as reality, as having no particular significance, as not connected at all to anything. And that's what a large part of politics is about, forcing you to divorce yourself from your history, from your culture, from even your common sense. So, let's go back to South Carolina, the subject I started talking about. So here is Hillary Clinton, and she is trolling, along with Bernie Sanders, trolling for votes. Now, let me be specific. trolling for black votes, because that's who's going to deliver victory. And we've known this all along. And it is incredible to me that black voters simply refuse to leverage the power that they have to extract and exact from this slave party what is required for them to lead a decent life. And they allow this party time and again to insult them, to malign them, to ignore them, and to do so at great peril, at the cost of life itself. So the news today is that Hillary is going to be trolling, but she's trolling classic white liberal style. And that is, she's going to get some black people to go down there and troll for her. And she got one. She got one. And he's a first. Who is that? It's Eric Holder. You remember him? The guy who couldn't deliver justice in Ferguson and in many places before, where black folks were being killed by police, and he didn't find any reason at all to extend the authority that he had as the first black U.S. Attorney General to prosecute anybody. He did a report, and then he left. Found no reason to investigate the prosecutor's office, found no reason at all to review the entire process. Well, he is the guy that Hillary now has trolling for black votes for her. She doesn't even have to show up anymore. She just sends the emissary, sends them out. You know, you talk black talk, you go out there, talk to those black people, you know, in black talk, and get them to do the right thing, which is flick that lever for Hillary Clinton. And he has gleefully accepted his assignment, because there he is. He will be accompanying Hillary Clinton in the South, trolling for black votes, going to black churches even, and asking people, in fact, telling them what a great person she is, what an absolute asset she will be in office. And he knows. He used to be U.S. Attorney General. He was a first black. He was the first black appointed by another first black. He's a twice first black guy. First black directly and first black by proxy. And I'm referring to Obama. Barack Obama used his State of the Union address literally to lay the platform, to build this platform for Hillary Clinton's launching as the next president of the United States. This is a woman who vilified him. This is a woman who showed him open disrespect, absolutely showed his wife disrespect. And here he is, on his way out, still loyal to Sister Hillary, and loyal to such a degree that the guy he appointed as the first black, he appointed a second first black. Follow this. He appointed Loretta Lynch after Eric Holder left. She is now the first black woman U.S. Attorney General. So it's a lot of firsts going on here. And Hillary is the beneficiary of all of that. She is to be the beneficiary of all of that, not because she deserves it, not because she worked hard for it, but because these folks understand intuitively what their job is. And they are interlopers, and they are showing clearly that the last 8 years that Barack Obama was in office, it was really because, by some fluke, black people and conscious people who provided that groundswell, but I'm talking the black vote was the driver here in the election of Barack Obama. And all of that has been transmuted now to supposedly help elect the Bonnie of the Bonnie and Clyde duo, Hillary Clinton. Why? For what reason? What exactly are her credentials in the black community? What has she done for black people? A woman who, and again, Eric Holder should be very, very careful about his association. Here is a candidate that he is now going to sell to black people who has a dubious distinction of being the first quasi-first lady to be so frequently subpoenaed in connection with criminal investigations. She stands there as pure as this driven snow. But we should keep in mind, it's more like New York snow. New York snow is just not white. It just isn't. We got dogs there. And they do like to relieve themselves in the snow. And that's the kind of snow that Hillary Clinton is. New York snow. This should so profoundly offend the entire black world that today, with the announcement that Eric Holder is in, well, Barack Obama announced he's in. He just did that. I'm with Hillary. Bernie Sanders, on the other hand, had to be made aware that there were black people in the universe. The socialist that he is, the democratic socialist in a very white state, had to be compelled to recognize that black people exist and that they have special demands. The hawk posing as a socialist, black people had to educate him about what the correct position ought to be on at least one key issue affecting the African-American community, and that is police executions of unarmed blacks. To his credit, he took a bruising, and he kind of decided, well, okay, I'll give you something. Hillary Clinton just talks. You can't believe anything she says. She is a predicate liar. You can't believe anything she says. She is, after all, the wife of Bill Clinton. And they're now grooming Chelsea. You know, it's interesting. When your in-laws, when your father-in-law was the guy that your father pardoned on a federal rap just before he also impeached, left office. That's the kind of fine, upstanding citizens these people are. But they are worthy of the black vote, not because they identify with anything. Just get there and vote for us. Just get there and vote for me. Bernie Sanders is saying it. Saying that, well, look, I finally came around to recognizing this issue. Give me some credit by giving me your votes. Hillary Clinton just says, listen, you better vote for me because I am entitled to it. And you should do this because, really, I should have been president 8 years ago. But you people, and she's the classic liberal, you people prevented my rise as the great star that I am. So get it right this time. And they're sending out the emissaries. They sent out Al Sharpton. Well, you know, he's available to whoever pays the highest. They sent out Marc Morial, the president of the National Urban League. But what do you know? Shocking, shocking, shocking. He's a Hillary guy. And their job is just one thing. Go out there and you talk that black talk. You get your black people to do the right thing and vote for the Democratic Party. But here is how we should really interpret this. The Democratic Party cannot survive. It can't win a damn thing without the black vote. That's power enough. I already explained to you the mortal sin for which Jesse Jackson should never be forgiven. The Jesse Jackson who ran in 1984 and in 1988 and carried, decisively carried South Carolina. He is a son of the state. He was born there in Greenville. But let's take a look at the wasted opportunity and the wasted power here. Jesse Jackson did remarkably well as a totally new aspiring candidate. He didn't have much money in his so-called war chest. And yet, in his first try running for the presidency, he wasn't the first African-American to run. Shirley Chisholm did that. But he got some serious backing. He got about 3.5 million votes. But he carried South Carolina. He did remarkably well as a brand new guy in the field. And what did that say back in 1984? It said that people, when they recognize someone articulating their interests, someone linked to them, someone connected to them, someone who would carry the banner for them, they will deliver. And black folks, I don't care what anybody says, black folks, proportionately, when you do a comparative analysis, you see black folks voting conscientiously, when there's a reason to vote. And in some cases, as we saw with the two elections of Barack Obama, outvoting just about every other ethnic group, bar none. So in 1984, Jesse Jackson did very, very well, winning 3,282,431 votes. That was almost 20% of the total votes cast in that election year. That is a spectacular performance. Now, some people would say, well, that's, he didn't win. Well, I look at winning very differently. If you're going up against really well-funded campaigns and candidates, you don't have too much of a war chest. All you have is spit and chewing gum and a determination, and people are behind you. The grassroots really is behind you, and you manage with all of these things that no sane person would dismiss. You manage just the same to edge up to 20% of the national vote. You have, my friend, you have won. You have proved a fantastic point. But that's when Jesse was quasi-genuine. So in 1984, he gets that. And then what happens in 1988? He just about doubles. He doubles the 1984 performance, which is spectacular. Again, he did not win the presidency. I am not fixed on winning, defining winning the way people are. I call that a spectacular victory. Because he went from 3.2 to almost 7 million votes the next time around as the rainbow candidate. the big bass in South Carolina. Now, from handing over that from 1984, is growing. But South Carolina was where he made a mark. And South Carolina, you can argue, set the pace. It gave legitimacy to a candidacy that, if genuinely rooted in the interests of the people, will absolutely be supported. He proved that. This was the second time. But between 1984 and 1988, Jesse Jackson went from true insurgent to a slave of the Democratic Party, and he took all of those 7 million votes and put them on the auction block. Didn't even blink an eye. And this movement, which was what the people created, the movement now became merely the conduit for his personal gain. He had no further interest in building and constructing a movement, a third way, a move away from that slaveocracy party called the Democrats. And yet he proved the validity and the legitimacy of the idea, the workability of it. You see? He was happy instead simply to transmute all of that into a personal asset. And he killed, I'm speaking really tough language here, Jesse Jackson killed his own movement. He killed it. So this momentum that began in 1984 was dead, DOA, in 1988. And it has yet to be revived. Because, among other things, what Jesse Jackson did and allowed the Democratic Party to do was to also make a method, create a method of controlling what clearly was rising political aspirations and a development of a political consciousness, principally among African Americans, but certainly among people of color, and certainly among the working class. It was driven, however, principally by the core supporters, the black grassroots vote. The bourgeois blacks were not there. The bourgeois blacks were trying their very best to kill this movement, the rise of a movement. And they finally got their man. And he said, you can have the movement too. I'll play the game. Just give me what I want. And I myself will perform the surgery and cut the artery, the carotid artery of this rising political movement. But now, that lays the groundwork of the black community reverting to pre-1984. You made a couple of steps forward, and the guy your guy, the horse you're betting on, has basically doped himself. Say, listen, I feel pretty good right here, right now. I don't need to go to the finish line. And since that time until now, people have been languishing for authentic political leadership, homegrown, organically grown leadership. We don't have it. Jesse Jackson created that model, and for that he is to be blamed. He has to accept it. He killed political momentum. But enough of a carcass was left enough of the bones were left to reconstruct something, and then they found a new guy named Barack Obama. And he had even greater dimension and therefore greater potential to be the agent of the retardation of black political power by seeming like a person who actually was interested in picking up that gauntlet and running with it. Same, but it's the same thing, the same result. 8 years in office, and you have a rough time reconciling the return on the investment that blacks have made in this president. Not just once. They were asked to get him in the door. They did. They were asked to keep him in the office. They did. And this is the same guy whose administration remained practically just out of touch with what black people wanted. Not just black people, but any really conscious person would feel inclined, in fact, would feel compelled to deliver, to put at the top of the list. They're talking about now he's very proud. The State of the Union is great. Well, it depends on who you talk to. The people I talk to don't think it's great. You're telling black America, Latino America, how great it is. Employment is the best it has been in years. Well, it depends on the color of your skin. Not too long ago, the unemployment rate for African Americans was at the highest since the Great Depression. And at least, it remains at least, this is according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, at least twice that of the national average, consistently. It hasn't changed. We are not even discussing unemployment as it relates to young people who are work eligible, who are trying to get a job. And we tolerate this. But we go back to South Carolina. And this is why it's so important to understand the significance of South Carolina. Neither Hillary Clinton nor Bernie Sanders nor Martin O'Malley or anybody else who would probably just miraculously show up and add him or herself to the list of candidates. Nobody can win decisively, certainly, without the black vote and the Latino vote. But the black vote is pivotal, especially for the Democratic Party. The Latino vote is very interesting in that they have taken the position. It is the best position ever. We support whoever supports us. It's plain and simple. I like that. We support who supports us. Interests, not emotion, interests are driving their political decisions, as it ought to be. Black folks have some strange emotional problem. Their circuitry is bad. The president sitting in the seat of white supremacy, singing a song about Amazing Grace. And he doesn't get it. That he was a perfect example of the completion of the process of dismembering you. You're so out of touch with everything, you can't make sense of anything. Nobody around you was even able to say, you know what, we have to change the venue. You don't have to give any explanation and say, hey, you see, the president is not about to be dwarfed by the statue of a white supremacist. It's just not going to happen. And then Hillary shows up at a black church and starts talking nonsense to, I played the speech here. You're talking to black people and you're telling them you identify with them. This is 2016, and this is coming from a supposedly evolved feminist. And what she feels she has in common with the people she's speaking to is that her mother was a maid, she says. I understand you. My mother was a maid. And that woman was allowed to finish her speech. Nobody got up and smacked her. And even then, she was in a church and still lying. The mother wasn't a maid. The mother was a runaway. She ran away as a teenager, and somebody took her in. And in exchange for room and board, she had to help out. But this is what we get when we refuse to make these links. All we are hearing is that the battle is on, and it's on in South Carolina. Nobody making the historical reference here. Nobody making the case that the time certainly has come to revise, radically revise our thinking about this whole political process. There is nothing in it for us the way it's going. So leave it. There is nothing there for you. You are of greater use to them than they are of to you. So why are you so enmeshed in this? And you are enmeshed because they have captured your leadership and enslaved them, and they in turn are re-enslaving you, getting you to believe that these people actually mean you well, that they actually have your interests at heart, that they actually would do something. And what are you asking for? They're not even prepared to deliver the basics. The basics. Black folks are not asking for huge things. Poor people are not asking for the sky and the moon. They want decent schools, but you're shutting them down. And that is under the black president that you put there. They want decent health care, and you don't have it. You can't afford it, even with so-called Obamacare written by Hillary Clinton and a cabal of insurance companies who wrote the law and gave Barack Obama the assignment to get it done. Now she says very adroitly that she supports Barack Obama's Obamacare because she knows there are problems with it. She has distanced herself from her own handiwork, made him go and do it. Made him, as a president of the United States, made him trot around like a thing on a set of a movie. You're a prop. He's my buddy, she said. Speaking of a president, and she is Secretary of State, and that too was a concession. I don't hear anybody asking, how did she become senator? How do you become senator when you never held public office before? You just walked out of the White House after that spat with your husband. And as a concession to you for being the faithful wife, you get rewarded with a U.S. Senate seat. Where are all the feminists who should be upset about that? talking about merit. And then you demand and you get, by virtue of your feminist pressures and the money that you have, and the fact that you know full well that you are in control of all of these so-called black leaders. They're not independent of you. You own them. So you can walk into Barack Obama's office and say, hey, you are looking at your next Secretary of State. And a person who doesn't even speak a foreign language, whose record as an attorney is certainly specious and up for deep questioning, whose entire history is up for questioning, that's the prize you give her. Because that was her intention, to use you to get to the top. I've seen this before. And now, the next assignment for Barack Obama, which he has already begun to fulfill, is to make sure that Hillary gets in. And the one place that he absolutely must shine is back in quote, his community, unquote. Because black folks will forgive anything. They forgive traitors and liars and deceivers. They forgive people who intentionally do them harm. They forgive miscreants and downright criminals. They forgive them all. As long as they give them a compliment or two. We're so starved for affection and attention. Just make a promise and everything will be all right. But you will see the speeding up of the emissaries being sent out. The people who are supposed to be leaders unequivocally having caved in will now be sent out to encourage us to do the same in the name of the Democratic Party and absolutely to get Hillary. Now, this is it specifically. It's not even just the Democratic Party. It's to get Hillary elected. That's our job. You and your silly, silly, unimportant interests are not even remotely close to getting any attention. Your silly demands about schools and police killings and jobs and a future and good housing and access to food and all these silly, nonsensical interests of yours have nothing to do with my ambition. And that's the shared ethic, if I dare use that word. That's the shared ethic of the Democrats who call themselves leaders, who troll the black community for the only last thing it's got, which is the vote. And they're doing everything possible. They just want that vote. They don't care about you after that. Just give us the vote so we could fulfill this symbolic idea that we have had an election and, quote, the people, unquote, have put us in office. When you understand what is going on, you therefore change the formula, the equation. And it wouldn't take too much to change. This is the thing. If black people really got serious, if the working class got serious, if the working poor got serious, we wouldn't be talking to any of these parties at all, begging them, pleading with them for a few crumbs from the table. You built the table. Dismantle the table if it no longer serves your purpose. Destroy it. Build your own table. Get out of this slavocracy, which is now intellectual, mental, psychological, emotional. You are still enslaved. Get out of it. You are in the hands. This party should represent to any conscious person, the Democratic Party, the Republicans, I'm not talking about them. I'm not talking about them yet. I'm talking about the party that for decades, centuries, these are the people, the mindset that has prevailed in this country. They embody it. And yet we are so loyal to it. So we have seen this party destroy the potential for independent politics. They destroyed it. They co-opted it and destroyed it. That's the Jesse Jackson reference. And that is a reference to these so-called leaders of these so-called civil rights organizations. They all co-opted. Not one of them has had the integrity to publicly criticize this party for failing to deliver. The return on investment has been negligible. And on that basis alone, this party deserves absolutely no support at all. Period. So you think about that. When CNN is telling you how great things are going and it's a great contest and blah, blah, blah in South Carolina. Just think about these little dots. I'm trying to help you connect them. The fix is in, my friends. But it's not too late to fix ourselves. Forget about fixing the problem. Fix your thinking. Because in the minds of the people that you want to help fix the problem, in those people's minds, guess who's the problem? You're the problem. Fix your mind and fix it this year. And fix your political circumstances this year. Anything other than the usual should apply this year. I made it very plain that no ethical person, no logical person would ever, if you've been a Democratic Party acolyte, this is your time to get out. We'll talk about other ways at another time. I just wanted to drive this point home today. And that's why I don't bother with people and the news and the slant they take. I have an entirely different reference point, as should you. And if you have a different reference point, you don't care what they're saying. They're making no sense to you. Because they are speaking through the prism through which they see the world. And that is not shared. We don't have the same view of the world. I thank you for joining me today, and I want to encourage you to stay tuned to PRN. Pass the word around about this wonderful station and the programs that are here on it. Coming up next is Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. I love the title of that program, Expanding Mind. That's the ultimate battle. The battle is for your mind. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking about these rants that I frequently indulge in. Let me know your ideas. And, of course, tomorrow is Free Your Mind Friday. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Thank you for joining me. See you tomorrow.